these opening notes have been a part of Western and even world culture for over 50 years. And while Bond has been rescuing the world in that time, the world has been changing. And in the most recent iteration of these chords and characters, Spectre, we find a conflict between good and bad, of course, but also between tradition and a technological future. Our big question is, do we still need 007 as a hero? Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Gina Kaufman, and it's Screen Time, our regular look at media that has people talking and us thinking. Today, we'll be grappling with the film Spectre. Joining us to do that, our film critic, Russ Simmons. Russ,
good morning. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And we also have Rachel Murphy Limecooler. She's a Bond and travel enthusiast. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
And then we also have Reza Derakhshani. He's an associate professor in the Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at UMKC. He also happens to be the chief scientist at iVerify. Morning, Reza.
Good morning, everyone.
Yeah. So as is the case with all of our Screen Time episodes, we really want to get into the depth of our story. So there will very likely be spoilers throughout this conversation. We'll do our best to remind you periodically, but this is your opportunity to weigh the potential risks to your personal enjoyment if you haven't seen Spectre yet. So we're moving forward. To start, Russ, what is the story of Spectre? Give us a little bit of an outline sketch.
Well, basically, in some ways, it's sort of a Bond's greatest hits in terms of theme points. But what we have is Daniel Craig, who is on the outs with his MI force, and he has been taken off the force temporarily. And it turns out that there happens to be an organization called Spectre that's been having terrorist attacks around the country, around the world, and the whole idea behind that is to try to undermine the existing intelligence forces and get them to combine into one that they can then infiltrate and take over the world.
Yeah, which it's a plan.
It's a plan.
and I'm curious what your your broad general review of your experience.
You know, I enjoyed the film a lot. I mean, it's got a lot of action. It's the beautiful Bond women, the beautiful cars. You know, it's everything you've come to expect, the car chases and all of the fun elements that we love in James Bond movies. It lacks, however, some of the humor that we had, you know, have the campiness that has come to be part of the James Bond franchise. And also, it's too long. It's 2 hours and 30 minutes, and I think it wasn't quite able to keep up enough interest for that length of time. But overall, I still enjoyed the film quite a bit, and I would put it probably in the middle group of the 26 Bond films.
Yeah. And Reza, what was your experience of the film in kind of general terms?
Yeah, I really liked the movie. It was very entertaining. However, I found it a little bit thinner on the tech side, and it was less cerebral than other Bond movies and, more action-packed, which nonetheless made it very, very entertaining.
I'm curious, you mentioned cerebral. There are some times when I don't think of Bond that way, but what are you thinking of when you're thinking about a cerebral Bond film?
Yeah, like something that has more of mind games going on and, a more sophisticated British plot rather than, explosions and car chases only.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking like, I feel like Skyfall, the one that preceded this, was a little bit more like that. Is that kind of what you're referencing?
Yeah, exactly.
And Rachel, do you agree with Russ's summary? And what was your experience of it?
I think middle of the pack is a perfect way to put it. I thought that it was a very entertaining movie, but as I walked away from the theater, the details had already started to fade on the edges a little bit. I really enjoy Daniel Craig as Bond. I think that the turn from away from the camp a little bit was a nice, refreshing reboot for the series. And I think that in a post-Bourne legacy, like, viewers world, you kind of need that. Like, they punched up the effects, they punched up the stakes of everything. And so it seems like a serious movie. It's not, no one blew up in their high heels or, sent a poison dart from their eyeglasses. So, yeah, the camp is gone, but I personally enjoy that.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I mentioned this earlier. It's kind of crazy to think that James Bond has been around longer, you know, than some people.
Yeah.
some buildings, you know, some major events, historical events have transpired in the last half century.
Right.
But I think that is in part because, you know, Bond is part of so many of our lives. I'm curious for you, Rachel, do you remember when you first met Mr. Bond?
Like, I don't. It is as ingrained in my gray matter as Star Wars or anything else. My dad was a big Bond fan, so being from a fairly conservative family, they would run through the naughty bits and let me see the, you know, skiing and car chases and things like that.
Wait, so. It, like, they would run through, like, the sexual parts
yeah,
of
yeah.
it? But they would stop and let you watch, like, men killing each other.
Oh, sure. We're Americans. This is how things work. No, I mean, the opening scene of Bond is always, you know, the big set piece that sets the tone, but often doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the movie. So the first 15 minutes before you first see that barrel and Bond appear within it are kind of the iconic things that, you know, for an action lover, you can get a lot of enjoyment when you're 7 out of that 15 minutes. And then you lose attention for it and, you know, go off to do something else.
And Russ, do you remember when you first discovered your shaken martini?
Yes, that was Goldfinger. Oh. That was the first one I ever saw. And I loved it so much that, of course, in those days, we didn't have a VCR. So I had to wait until the reruns came on TV for me to see the previous films. But you look back at Goldfinger now, and it's kind of, it really shows, you know, the dated aspects of it. But man, I remember at the time thinking it was the coolest thing ever.
What about it? Like,
well, for one thing, it had Oddjob, who was a an assassin, and he had a bowler hat which had razors on it. And so he would take it off and throw it at you like a frisbee and chop people's heads off. And I thought, man, wouldn't that be cool? And the whole course, it had the Aston Martin, which has become an iconic part of the Bond films, you know, with all the gadgetry that has come to be one of the earmarks of all the Bond franchise. And so it was just great fun.
Yeah. And so do you think it was like more of like a childhood nostalgia thing, or do you think it was just like the, you know, it was also like this movie that spoke to you kind of like on other levels as well?
I think it spoke to me on a lot of levels because, first of all, you have the beautiful women. And you know, even as a kid, you're thinking, wow, this is pretty cool. And the cars, which are fantastic. And so there was really not a whole lot that was like Bond back in those days. Mm-hmm. Of course, now there's so many imitators that, you know, even this summer we had The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which came out, which it's just Bond. The Mission Impossible films, they're Bond.
Right.
It's just a different play on those same themes. But that was new and different and exciting back in the day.
And Reza, I'm curious what your first encounter of Bond was like.
Interestingly enough, it was also Goldfinger. Obviously, Goldfinger was released before I was born, so I saw it on Betamax. I agree that, you know, probably the first thing that hit me was the cool flying hat as well, especially the scene when the guy actually decapitates a statue.
Right.
It's just like that sharp, and obviously, you know, as a young teenager, I found the beautiful ladies also very enticing in that movie.
Yes,
strangely, the women just didn't. Really
yeah,
do it.
And we'll get more into that, yeah. But. Do you remember which one was your first film? And like,
I think the one that made the biggest impact was probably On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Starts off with this like fantastic ski chase in the first 10 minutes or so. And then my dad always really loved the George Lazenby one because he was a one-off Bond. He was Australian. And he gets beat up in the first 10 minutes. And he gets up and he's like, well, that never happened to the other guy. I mean, he's very tongue-in-cheek, very breaking the fourth wall and saying, well, I know, I don't look anything like the guy before me. So, I mean, there was a lot of humor in that. That kind of stuck out.
And I find that interesting that you mentioned that, you know, like, because we've had many different men play Bond, and we've also had many different directors and writers. And Rachel, let's continue with you. But do you feel that there's a uniform idea of what Bond is?
No. I really don't. I think that if you look at the men that have embodied that role, they're so different, and very few of them actually are true to the original Ian Fleming description of what Bond is.
Which is what?
The closest visual would be Sean Connery, but the closest in acting style would be Daniel Craig. I mean, he's not a character with humor in my readings. Mm-hmm. I've only read a couple of the original novels, On Her Majesty's Secret Service and Casino Royale, but they're not funny books. they're just not. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very much based on Ian Fleming's own experiences in MI5, I believe. Mm-hmm. He was not MI6. And, you know, they were supposed to be suspense novels, closer to what most of us would think of as like Robert Ludlum. Mm-hmm. Or Tom Clancy, where, you know, there's a lot of technical stuff, there's a lot of adventure, sure, but it's not slapstick, it's not camp. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that Bond reflects the age that it's filmed in. You know, Timothy Dalton worked for the 80s and 90s. Looking back, I don't really love those movies. They're not my style. George Lazenby was reflective of the 60s. You know, these are all things that, you know, you're going to make a movie for what sells then, not what sells in 50 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I want to stick with you for a little while. I understand that you really are into traveling, and tell me a little bit about that.
I am. I've been to 20 countries now. Two of the four locations from the Spectre film, quite recently, actually. We were in London.
Which ones?
Yeah. We went to Morocco and London about a month ago. And so we were actually in London when the movie came out. And I'm kicking myself for not finding a cinema and seeing it there just for the bragging rights, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what, you know, the crowd would be like there versus, you know.
I will tell you that Daniel Craig was on every bus on a London street. It was just Spectre everywhere. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they're definitely proud of it. They have lots of cultural exports, but Bond is probably the one that they, you know, that's the feather in their cap.
And you were mentioning that you've read a number of the Bond, you were mentioning two of the Bond films. Did that precede or follow the films for you?
It's kind of intermingled.
Right.
I read On Her Majesty's Secret Service when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. just looking for something to read and pillaging my dad's bookshelf. And I read Casino Royale, actually, about 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, I was involved in a book club called the Silver Pages Book Club.
Was that here in Kansas City?
It was. It was a number of theater professionals and myself, and unfortunately, they've all scattered to the four winds. But we would read the book, the source material, and then watch the movie and compare the two. Mm-hmm. So reading Casino Royale, you realize that Ian Fleming definitely wrote in a very different time period, as far as social mores and sexual mores. And it's quite eye-opening. Mm-hmm. There was one line in particular where he is describing a liaison with a young lady, and he said that it had the sweet tang of rape.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like shocked. And it takes a lot to shock me when reading something that's kind of over the top anyway, but it was just like, wow, that's just not something that would fly in modern fiction. So, I mean, obviously they left that out of the movie.
Well,
it was decidedly unrapey.
Yeah, in the most recent one, that is correct.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there aren't many scenes of affirmative consent with women in any of the Bond films, even the one today. It's more just like he kisses them and they don't say no.
Right. But at this, from a filmmaker's standpoint, do we need to include, would you like to have coitus with me right now? Yes. Yes, I would, Daniel Craig. Yeah. I mean, that's just, it's not unrealistic. It breaks the flow of the film.
Right.
Like at a certain point, there has to be something naturalistic about the way scenes flow together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did, when you were reading the books, either, you know, most recently or previously, did they kind of change the way you thought about yourself, others, or the world? I mean, you were mentioning just it kind of put you in a different time and space in terms of like conventions.
Well, I've often been told that I could only have been born in the time period in which I was born because I'm fairly opinionated and quite out there with my thoughts as a woman. So, yeah, going back to the 50s and 60s, it's quite a different way of thinking of women's role in the workplace and things like that. You know, M as a woman was a huge shakeup for the Bond world when Judi Dench took over. Mm-hmm. And it certainly wasn't like that in the books. So these are things that it's like watching Mad Men. Mad Men was interesting to me from a standpoint of watching women interact complicitly in these roles. It wasn't obvious to them that they could do something else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a period piece for sure.
And do you feel that your love of travel was inspired in part by Bond or the depictions of travel in other media? Like, has that kind of been a through line for you? Or,
well, for full disclosure, I have two dogs named Indiana Jones and Short Round. So if that gives you any idea of my media influences, I mean, I think that Bond, Indiana Jones, any of those 80s films that were kind of throwbacks to the serial comics, those always go to cool places. They're doing cool things. The line moving across the map in Indiana Jones kind of forever stuck with me. And mm-hmm. it's always been something that I intended to do. My family traveled a lot when I was a kid, but they traveled domestically. We took mm-hmm. long car trips and camped and saw historical places in the United States. And as soon as I was financially solvent enough to get a credit card and run that thing up, I started flying further away.
And Inspector, what were some of the locations that stuck out to you? Was there anything you saw that was like, I must go there now?
I would really love to go to Mexico City. The opening scene, Inspector, happens during a Dia de Muertos celebration parade. And it's so lively and just colorful. And these are things like that holiday is kind of being co-opted by a lot of cultures in the world saying, oh, yeah, no, I get in on the sugar skull thing. I was like, yeah, I don't really think you understand what this means to this culture, but it is pretty. So that I would really love to do that. I had just been in Marrakesh, so the scenes in Tangiers definitely rang true, the claustrophobic nature of old walled cities and the marketplace and all of that. That was very realistic. And I've always wanted to go to Austria. I've been to the Swiss Alps, but not any of the rest of them. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they take this beautiful train ride through the Alps that is just fantastic right before everybody starts trying to kill each other. But mm-hmm. That sort of luxury train ride has always been a secret longing of mine.
Right. Russ, were there, you know, the way the scenes were depicted of the various locations, were there ones that stuck out to your mind as, you know, really kind of travel inspiring?
Yes, and there's some that made me think, no, I don't want to ever go there as well. I mean, the scenes out in the middle of the desert, you know, it doesn't seem like the most luxurious place to visit. But I agree about Mexico City. I mean, that opening sequence is tremendous, mm-hmm. and there were like 1,500 extras that they hired for that scene, mm-hmm. and the budget of the film, I think, was like $245 million, but it's all up there on the screen, and they made the most of that locale, and that'd be a place that would be cool to visit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things I find that about Bond that's so interesting about his, like, way he travels and goes to new places is that he, like, blindly walks into potentially or really clearly dangerous situations. Mm-hmm. For instance, Inspector, he simply travels to the lair of Ernst Stravo Bofeld. Is that how you say his name?
Bofeld.
Bofeld, the bad guy in the movie. His secret crater compound in the middle of the desert, knowing that, like, this is... Well, not having any plan to get from the train location to the actual, like, middle of the desert, and also knowing that this is, you know, a man who, you know, probably wants to do me harm because I just ran away from his whole apparatus when I was in Italy. And I'm curious, in your travels, Rachel, does that resonate with you? Just kind of...
Oh, yeah, I drop in on secret lairs all the time.
not the espionage part.
Sure.
But the idea of... just accepting whatever, you know, life hands you and not having a plan. Is that how you travel? Is that a realistic expectation?
I think that the best travel experiences come when you go with that mindset. I think that
When you travel like Bond travels?
Yes, with an unlimited budget and no customs to go through. There are two ways to travel. There are people that like structure, and there are people that like to see what comes. And I am definitely on the see what comes side of things. My husband is very much someone who wants to know that we have a bed at night. So I've had to sort of compromise on those things a little bit. But I think that some of the best experiences that I've had have been just soaking in a culture. Like, we went to Marrakesh, and there's lots of things you could do in Marrakesh. But part of the experience is just going and sitting and watching life go by, and then figuring out how you fit inside of it. One of the best things that I've ever done has just been to go out on any street in any city and anywhere in the world and turn right or turn left and just see where it takes you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are ways that you can get into a lot of trouble doing that. But I have found, to quote Blanche DuBois, that the kindness of strangers does exist. Mm-hmm. And I've been warned away from areas by people saying, you know, hey, Blondie, maybe you should go back to the tourist section of town. I've had people warn me when gypsies were trying to pickpocket me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are people care about each other more than you realize and more than you expect.
Reza, does that resonate with you? Have you, when you travel, do you travel like Bond or do you travel like a normal person?
I would say I'll travel more like a professor, you know, which is usually for conferences or business. Unfortunately, I have not had that kind of experience that Bond has, or fortunately, maybe. talking about the locations from a different angle,
yeah.
I found the crater compound in the desert. It kind of reminded me of some of the Star Wars scenes, mm-hmm. you know, where you have a high-tech facility in the middle of desert. So as a Star Wars fan, that was interesting to me.
And as someone who studies technology, like, is it like a practical thing? Like, have you ever, like, in terms of, you know, like, because I feel with Bond, it's both this clownish or cartoonish depiction of, you know, like what could be like a moon base, for example.
Right.
But at other times, it kind of shades of our actual reality. And there was something very stark about that place.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to the tech aspect, I think the only advantage you have if you're in the middle of a desert is if you're solar powered, mm-hmm. that would be the best place to have a base.
Yeah, but it also all blows up because apparently there's tons of gasoline there.
Absolutely. It has to, right?
Yeah. And is there something to be said about, like, this immeasurable kind of confidence and how Bond is able to just have the good luck to get into bad situations and then get out of them?
I think that many different science fiction and fantasy films, you have to go in with a certain willingness to suspend your disbelief. With Bond, there's a certain suspension of disbelief that you just completely accept. And when he does something that would be completely against what common sense would dictate, you just have to tell yourself, it's Bond. Mm-hmm. It's okay. And you just go with the flow.
Well, and I think that in certain ways, the reason why Bond can act with such confidence is because he has nothing to lose.
Yeah.
He has no ties. His only loyalty is to his country. And even that's a little shaky sometimes. He occasionally likes to take a vacation. But, you know, not having those ties, and that's what in several of the movies the women present is something that an enemy is going to put into his path that makes him feel something that would alter his tactics. Does he care about her enough to not risk what it takes to get the job done?
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, the answer is no, she's not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with a few exceptions.
And I want to take a step back for a minute, because we were all mentioning the opening of the film. Those first image is of skulls, and we discover that we're, you know, hovering around and within a crowd in Mexico City. And it's a very long tracking shot. Russ, can you, like, just, you know, refresh our memory about, like, what a tracking shot is and kind of take us through what what we saw in that just one take?
Right. I know that I read up on this a little bit, so I know that it's not a legit single shot.
Oh,
they use
really?
They use some tricks, like in like they did with last year with Birdman, which was a movie that was done all in one shot, or so it appeared. But there were some seamless, I thought, cuts. But what you see is the camera is following Bond through the streets of Mexico City, into a hotel, out of a hotel, onto the roof, and through all of this confrontation. And before he jumps on the helicopter and the rest of the action sequence plays itself out, it appears to be a single long tracking shot. And it's all done with a Steadicam.
Which is a camera that's like attached to a human body, but it has like gyroscopes and counterweights in it to keep the camera actually level and steady.
Correct.
If you ever walked around with like an iPhone, you'll realize that your image is really bouncy.
Right. But it was very impressive. As a matter of fact, as I was sitting there with my wife, I poked her and I said, "This is one shot." And it was like at least 4 minutes into the film that I realized that there hadn't been any cuts.
Yeah. I'm curious, the thing that I found interesting about this was like it kind of set this whole tone for this kind of like fluid kind of depiction of Bond, which is not typically how it's like shot. But I don't remember seeing that same style used again at all. And I'm curious if other people recall like other long tracking shots in the film that like wanted to show us something in a really particular way like that.
Yeah, I don't recall any other scenes like that, but it's known that the set piece of the Bond film is the opening sequence, and I thought they did a bang-up job. It may be the best opening sequence ever.
Mm-hmm. For a Bond film.
For a Bond film.
Well, and I think we need to remember that the director of this film was Sam Mendes. This is not some random guy that they got to direct
Oscar
this
winner.
Film. This is Oscar-winning, American Beauty. I mean, he has a visual style that is very distinctive, and he has the chops to pull off whatever he wants to pull off. Mm-hmm. And apparently the budget, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Reza, did you see, can we drill down a little bit? Was there anything more that you saw in that opening shot?
I was focused on the CGI and the effect, which is called Uncanny Valley, right? If something is too artificial, you know, you're like, okay, it's supposed to be that way. If it's really realistic, you don't even notice it. But if something is a little bit off, then, you know, you have that weird feeling, which is called the uncanny valley, that you observe in CGI.
Did you feel it when you were watching that?
Just for a brief moment when the roof was collapsing and as Bond was trying to leap over. For a second, this is really hard to pull off with all those dust particles and everything following the laws of physics. I don't know, maybe Ross, you felt it as well. That's when I felt the uncanny valley in that sequence. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I thought they did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that was the only part that seemed artificial about that.
Well, we're going to take a very quick break. And we want to know, do you feel like Bond still works as a character? Do we still need his story today? You can call 816-235-2888 during the break. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, and I'm in for Gina Kaufman. It's our Screen Time episode when we take a close look at media that's making us think. And we're looking at the most recent Bond film, Spectre. And our question today is, do we need James Bond as a hero? Is he relevant? Does he still show us something we need or want to see? Join us by our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And joining me to try to grapple with this specter and the film itself are Russ Simmons. He's a film critic. Welcome back, Russ.
Thanks.
And Rachel Murphy Limecooler. She's a Bond and travel enthusiast, and she joins us here as well. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
And then Reza Derek Shani. He's an associate professor in the Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at UMKC. He also is the chief scientist at iVerify. Hey, Reza.
Hey.
And just as a reminder, there will be spoilers throughout this conversation. So if that's something that means can make or break a film or an experience for you, now might be a good time to consider what to do next. I think that the technology has always been a big part of Bond films. And Reza, some of the gadgets even become real-life equipment years after they appear in the film. You know a little bit about this, don't you?
I suppose so. As you mentioned, there have been gadgets or tech-related scenes in previous Bond movies that actually became reality to some extent. We can think about the multi-touch table in Quantum of Solace, which was a 2008, and actually Microsoft created a touchscreen multi-touch table, and obviously we all have touchscreen devices. So, multifunction cell phones. Tomorrow Never Dies, which was 1997.
Seems like forever ago.
Absolutely. There was a Sony Ericsson that could remotely operate your car. Obviously, we have Tesla cars that, you know, you can control them with your cell phone apps. They had in that phone, you had the capability of scanning a fingerprint, and fingerprint scanners or biometric scanners are becoming commonplace in our cellular phones. Going back to Quantum of Solace, the 2008, there was also another cell phone that was connected to MI6's image database, so you could scan a crowd and do facial recognition to find the bad guys. So that has become a reality as well.
Mm. And can you briefly tell us the work that iVerify does?
Some of you guys might know, one of my previous inventions at UMKC, which was about scanning the eyes, the white of the eyes, to match the vein patterns in the white of the eyes as another fingerprint, right? But this time using a regular camera, turned into a local startup, iVerify, it has grown to international company right now. So we're doing biometrics there.
And this kind of, I remember this kind of identification technology as a kid, particularly in like Cold War films, you know, to get into a secret lair, having to scan the eye to gain access into
right.
a place. Was that part of the inspiration for your invention, or did it come from some other place?
You know what? That's a very interesting thing. I don't know. Probably. eyes have always been fascinating. They're very dense in terms of information. They have been called the windows to the soul. So you can glean a lot of information from the eyes. Obviously, there has been iris scans. Now we have introduced iPrint ID, which is, you know, veins in white of the eye and microfeatures around the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that, people usually don't mess with their eyes. You know, you can go under surgery to change your face, but it's got to be a little bit harder to mess with your eyes. Of course, we have movies, again, actually a Bond movie, Never Say Never. There is a scene when this guy gets a corneal implant or something like that and changes his iris patterns to get into this weapon system, impersonate the U.S. president, and basically extort money by having the launch code for the missiles.
Mm-hmm. So has this eye recognition biometric technology been around for a while, just not like in a kind of commercial public way? It was just about, you know, adjusting it to fit the technology in the palm of our hand.
Right. Yeah. So iris recognition was introduced in the late 90s. Became a thing, in the late 80s, became a thing in the late 90s, but mostly for border control and so forth. But eye recognition, as you know, as a consumer technology, such as fingerprints, now we have eye prints and iris scanners in our cell phones, and that has happened just recently with the advancement in the mobile technology. Mm-hmm. So iVerify was founded in 2012, and it's been just recently that we have launched our product internationally.
Mm-hmm. As a person, did you dream of inventions? Was your inspiration coming from film?
I would say so. I think my first inspiration was the $6 Million Man. So that's when I started really being inspired by movies, and it was Space 1999. Unfortunately, we don't have the moon base yet. I would say so, and obviously Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Smart Blood in this film. Mm-hmm. Reza, can you set up where we first are introduced to Smart Blood and what it does in this James Bond world?
Sure. So the Smart Blood in this movie, Spectre, was supposed to act as a tracking device. If you will, it's like a microchip that you get, for your pets. But this time, it's active and can be remotely, for example, via satellite or cell phone triangulation, track where the person is. I guess they had to make it small enough that could circulate in James Bond's bloodstream without killing him.
Mm-hmm. And how far-fetched is this idea of, as you were mentioning, we do put chips in our pets.
Right.
We also put them in our passports.
Correct.
But how far-fetched is this idea?
So as an injectable bloodstream type of nanotechnology, it's pretty far-fetched. But other versions of it do exist. The RFID chip that we were talking about, that works only in close proximity. So you have to have the scanner right next to where the microchip is. But the active version that can transmit a signal, I haven't seen it in production, but I'm sure there are parents that would wish they could microchip their kids to see where they are in that manner.
Yeah. So I saw two simultaneous things going on that were kind of challenging in this Smart Blood scene where Q is injecting James Bond with these essentially robots or chips that allow him to be watched everywhere. One is, of course, surveillance. But the other idea is implanting technology into our own bodies. Mm-hmm. Do you find either of those concepts troubling? Now, outside of the James Bond film, did it set you aback when you were watching it, or was it something that seemed kind of, who wouldn't?
I would say the latter. One of the things that we did research on in my lab is called brain-computer interfaces. So it's not something out of the sci-fi realm anymore to have interfaces with, for example, our nervous system. Actually, we have retinal implants that can make the blind see again. And in case of brain-computer interfaces, we have FDA-approved devices where a quadriplegic can actually move or operate a computer.
Mm-hmm. And want to take a caller here. Darren called in from Mission. Darren, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for taking my call. So you mentioned earlier, is James Bond still relevant?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we still need James Bond? And I think the answer is yes. One of the things I really like about, most James Bond movies is it's usually not a nation or an army or a people that's usually is the aggressor. It's usually one person that maybe started off in a nation or an army or a group of people and has kind of gone off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially in light of recent events, that's very relevant. And it's always maybe nice to know, even if it's not always realistic, that there's somebody out there or some nation out there that's kind of protecting us. And again, maybe that's a false sense of a warm fuzzy, but it definitely is good storytelling.
But it is a story that seems to resonate with you. Thank you. Thank you, Darren. And to return briefly to technology, Rachel, I'm curious, you know, that's the beginning moments of like really talking about surveillance in the film.
It is. And England is a very surveillance friendly country. And it's pretty apparent. It's not that you feel like you're being watched necessarily. We're still a little ways off from Big Brother and George Orwell, but you can see cameras in almost every intersection in public spaces. There's very little that you can do in England that could not or will not be watched in some manner. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've found has really sort of worked its way into their pop culture as well. If you look at any of the current shows that are on, Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman deals with this very specifically in some of their storylines, that they can go and they can find surveillance footage going in and out of any public building or place where something might have happened. What makes this far-fetched is that James Bond seems to be impervious to surveillance and can go wherever he wants, whenever, and no one seems to know where he is, even though he's has smart blood and cameras on him at all times. And, you know, it's that willing suspension of disbelief that you kind of have to go with to make those stories work. But it's a very real part of their lives. And it's one that Americans sort of bristle at, but it's commonplace there.
Well, we're going to take one more quick break. There's still time to join our conversation very briefly. If you want to talk about Spectre, by calling 816-235-2888. I'm Matthew Law Middleton. We'll pick right up with Spectre and surveillance and technology. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Matthew Law Middleton, in for Gina Kaufman. It's Screen Time, when we take a close look at the media that is making us think. And we're looking at the most recent Bond film, Spectre, today. Joining me is Russ Simmons, Rachel Murphy Lime Cooler, and Reza Derakhshani. And we're going to get right back into it here. One of the biggest tropes in Bond is his relationship with cars. And Reza, have there been any cars in the history of Bond that have really captured your imagination?
Obviously, the Aston Martin. The Aston Martin being the first one, Jaguar being the second, we had Range Rovers also in this movie, or Land Rovers. Mm-hmm. That obviously the DB10 that they showed in this movie, they
Aston handmade Martin DB10.
Yeah, they made 10 of them. I guess at least one of them was used in this movie.
And if you're in the market, there are 9 others you can try to grab. And I'm curious, though. I thought that there were some really interesting things that actually we. Really interesting choice about technology not present in the car. Mm-hmm. There were no touch screens, only simple toggle switches.
Exactly.
And I'm curious, you know, what you folks thought of that, and about like what's that trying to show us or not show us, Russ?
Well, it's obviously very retro. And as a matter of fact, I don't know what that one sports car that he drove to the Spectre meeting was, but man,
I think I think it was the Aston Martin.
That was
DB10.
Okay, well, the thing that I thought was cool about the original Aston Martin was the technology that allowed him to escape, and it had machine guns, it had bullet deflectors, it had oil slick creators, you know, it had flamethrowers.
All these things seemed like kind of throwbacks and homages to the old Bond.
Exactly. But in this one, you know, the souped up one, it's just, to me, when he drove up to that meeting, I thought, well, that's inconspicuous. no one's going to notice that. But at the end of the movie, well, I don't want to give that away, but
you can.
He goes back to the old
spoiler
Aston
alert,
Martin.
Everybody.
Yeah. And I could fully see why, because the romance of that car is still alive.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that for me, the toggle switches were one of the more realistic options, because if you are driving 140 kilometers an hour behind someone, do you have time to be like, oh, which touch screen should I touch right now? No, you go up or you go down, and hopefully fire comes out. In this case, it didn't. That was probably one of the funnier parts of the movie for me, was the failure of the tech, because he relies so heavily on it and so much. But Toggles, it is retro. It is a throwback, but so is the Aston Martin. The Aston Martin is not the car that he has driven in most of these movies. It's something that came back quite recently in the last decade or so of films as this nostalgia piece, and everyone associates that with him. But he's driven Ferraris and Lamborghinis and Jaguars and Porsches, and there's no car that James Bond won't blow up sooner or later.
And we have very limited time, sadly. I feel badly about this, but I do want to talk about like women in this film, because I still feel that there are problematic things throughout this. And Rachel, I'm curious what you thought when you were watching it, what your feelings were.
You know, if I had seen the movie without reading any of the media beforehand, I wouldn't have thought anything of it. Monica Bellucci is a beautiful woman. She will be a beautiful woman until she dies. But there was a lot made over her involvement because she is like 4 years older than Daniel Craig. She's in the movie for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
She is basically seduced for information, and then you never hear from her again. This was sort of put
after
out there.
Bond says, I'll keep you safe.
Right.
By leaving you.
By leaving you? I'm kind of confused as to how he's going to do that. But still, the primary relationship is between Bond and a woman half his age. She is literally the daughter of his sworn enemy. There are no feminist strides in this movie, and anybody who is trying to sell you that is absolutely lying.
Russ?
He's definitely the misogynist that we've all known him to be for, you know, all of the decades that we've enjoyed the movies. But you would hope that maybe he would make some strides in that regard. But nope, it's still Bond and the young, beautiful women, and that fulfills a definite male fantasy that makes it attractive to a lot of guys.
I mean, like, this is the thing that I find so amazing, and kind of gets to this other point about, like, you know, is Bond the hero we need today? I just feel like, why has he not changed yet? How has he not changed in this way?
That's a good point. I think that we should talk to the filmmakers about that, because that could be an interesting development in this character, is and see how his relationship with women can advance.
Well, but what is that supposed to attain other than speaking to the overall sensibility of the viewing audience? Mm-hmm. What does that move in the storyline?
Mm-hmm.
The storyline, these are not romance movies.
Right.
These are not movies about his deep-seated mother issues or his relationship with women. They're about accomplishing a goal. And there are things that you expect from a Bond movie. You want fast cars. You want chases. You want tech. You want someone beautiful. And as a woman, I want Daniel Craig all the time, every day. You know, these are things that, you know, from a woman's perspective, too, I watch this because there is a highly attractive gentleman in a tux doing some cool stuff. Like, these are not documentaries, and they're not pieces that are meant to spur an overall cultural conversation.
So in the final moments of our show right here, real quick, what are your hopes for the next Bond film, Rachel?
Ooh, that we get out of his past. I'm over the daddy issues.
Mm-hmm. Reza?
More technology.
And Russ?
Although I think Daniel Craig is a great Bond, I would love to see Idris Elba, who's someone who we've been talking about. He would be a tremendous Bond.
Yes,
and
it would also change the color barrier for
right.
for Bonds over time. Well, until that time, our show is up for today. Rachel Murphy Limecooler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Reza Derek Shani, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Russ, as always.
Good to be with you.
That's Central Standard for this morning. You can listen back to anything you've heard at kcur.org/Central Standard. The show will be up later this afternoon. We've had a great week of shows, from fossils to unpacking terms that have dominated the headlines in Mizzou and more. So if you want to catch up on any of that, kcur.org/Central Standard. On Monday, we'll be opening up at cans of cream of mushroom soup to investigate how green bean casserole and other dishes define the Midwest ethos. KCUR is produced by myself. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Fridays are brought to you by Jen Chen. Linda Scher is our announcer and board operator. We had special help this week from Andrea Tuttle and our trusty intern, Kyle Smith. Our music is produced by Spoonbender Labs. Gina Kaufman is the host of the show, and she will be back next week. Until then, stay with us because Up to Date is next.
You've been listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR HD1, Kansas City Public Media. Good morning, I'm Linda Scher, and indeed, Up to Date is coming up next, so stay with us. Today on Here and Now, is President Obama using the right language in the wake of the Paris attacks? We discuss the language used when talking about terrorism and why it matters on Here and Now, today from noon to 2 on KCUR. Central Standard is supported by Universal Pictures' By the Sea, a new film about the tenacity of love that stars Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie Pitt. Written and directed by Angelina Jolie Pitt. Now playing in select theaters. 48 degrees, overcast skies in Midtown Kansas City at 11.